Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.
There's a couple of times we thought about filing a suit if a permit was denied, but eventually decided that it was not worth our time.
Did that lead to NG just walking away from a project altogether?
If it was just permitting, it would have been one thing, but there was other factors that were playing against us. Taken as a whole was just not worth our time pursuing.
As the renewable energy industry has grown up, its legal risks have too. Sure, we as an industry talk all the time about NIMBYism, but what about zoning and permitting litigation? What happens when a project produces stormwater runoff that damages a neighboring property? And how about all these new incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act? Who's on the hook if a project falls short of its obligations? I'm John Engle, Content Director for Renewable Energy World. This week on Factor This, I'm joined by two attorneys working really closely on these issues. Matthew Carmel is the principal and chair of the Environmental and Sustainability Practice Group at the national law firm Offutt Kerman. And Yana Spitzer is an in-house counsel at NG North America. Matthew and Yana take us inside the courtroom for a look at the legal risks plaguing project developers today, and they point out the potholes to watch out for in the future. That's all next on Factor This from Renewable Energy World.
The RISE Speakers Bureau is a public searchable database of diverse, qualified speakers willing to publicly speak, present, and engage on renewable energy topics. This episode's featured speaker is Patricia Vega, founder and CEO of Quantum New Energy. Patricia's expertise includes asset management, corporate social responsibility, energy efficiency, and more. Contact Patricia for a speaking engagement, view other speakers, or join the Speakers Bureau yourself by visiting riseenergy.org. That's WRISENERGY.org.
Matthew Carmel and Yana Spitzer, thanks for joining the Factor This podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us, John.
Yeah, I really look forward to these kinds of news you can use episodes because, you know, we often talk on this podcast about how the promise and opportunity of the Inflation Reduction Act does face some, you know, very real implementation hurdles. And I think you both have perspectives that can help the folks listening to this podcast hopefully avoid or overcome some of those hurdles. So before we get too far down the line, why don't we both start off by you quickly introducing yourselves and what you do. Yana, why don't you kick us off?
Thanks, John. I am a in-house counsel at NG North America. I support the distributed solar and storage team from anywhere from origination, development, construction to operations of solar and storage projects that our teams are building. Been in law for the last 10 years, been at NG for a little over a year. Prior to that, I've been in private practice prior to joining the in-house world. That's a little bit about me.
And Matt, why don't you take it from there?
Thanks. I'm Matt Carmel. I'm an attorney at Offutt Kerman, which is a full-service Am Law 200 law firm with a national footprint and regional expertise. You know, my practice focuses on environmental law. So in addition to traditional environmental compliance and counseling, I work with a lot of different parties, property owners, developers, technology providers on various things relating to renewable energy, site acquisition, development, financing, mergers, acquisitions, litigation. And I have experience across renewables platforms, you know, from solar to RNG to alternative fuels. And in my spare time, I manage a newsletter called the Planetary Lawyer Project, which helps lawyers to do more climate-friendly work.
Before we go too much further, should we point out for the listeners that they won't be billed for this hour? Is that kind of a lame lawyer joke?
Or I still like it.
All the time. Okay. It still plays? That's good. Well, Yana didn't say anything, so maybe she will say.
I don't miss the billable world at all. So that's all on Matt.
All right. No invoices from Yana. Okay. So let's frame this conversation by starting with some high level trends. I think that'll guide us as we go through this interview. What are you seeing as key trends in litigation that developers and the industry at large need to be aware of to make sure that they don't end up in front of a judge?
And before you do that, let me totally oversimplify this entire episode. Give me like a rating one to 10 of how risky this legal environment is right now for the clean energy industry compared to maybe, you know, years past, with 10 being the trickiest, if it's possible to simplify that much.
Oh, that's a good question. So I think I put us somewhere at a 6 or a 7. Sometimes I'm accused of underrating things, of underestimating things, but I think that's where it is. We've got a lot of risks, and solar development, especially really large scale solar development, which we'll talk about later in this episode, comes with more risks. Some of these things are just the cost of doing business, and some of them are risks that we can really manage and avoid. And at that really high level, some of the litigation trends that we're looking forward, that we're seeing moving forward in 2023 are, one, we're going to keep seeing community challenges, community opposition, NIMBYism, really. People who don't want, residents in communities that don't want projects in their backyards. We're also going to continue seeing, you know, challenges from municipalities, which is a related issue. And then I think we're going to see an expansion of consumer fraud and consumer protection litigation. There's been a host of state entities that have been suing different solar companies over consumer protection issues. And as community solar expands, more and more companies are moving into direct relationships with consumers that otherwise weren't in the past. And so I think we're going to continue to see those types of cases. I think then looking even further forward, everyone's talking about climate in different ways. And I think climate is going to start to intersect with renewable energy litigation, with solar litigation. And we're seeing that come up a little bit with some environmental damage cases that have come up with stormwater runoff and other issues like that. And I think we're going to see an expansion of those in the coming years. And then I think the last thing is we're going to continue to see really traditional competitor type litigation, breach of contract, competition type issues. But we're going to see that with a special Inflation Reduction Act flavor in 2023 and beyond.
And Jana, I'll let you give your 1 to 10 as well. I'm wondering if you could also frame your perspective, given that you are relatively new, at least in-house at NG, of maybe what some of the newer trends are. Like, we've been talking about NIMBYism a lot in this industry for years, but has anything started to percolate that maybe wasn't a condition we were facing, I don't know, a decade ago or so?
I think that we'll agree with the outline that Matt gave. I guess recently the supply chain and pricing issues have been coming up. I haven't seen any, personally have not seen any litigation raised up by that, but that has been a problem to get projects online or to even get them built on time. So that could be a possible issue. As Matt mentioned, the Inflation Reduction Act and the lack of government's guidelines as to specifically when it pertains to, you know, the credits that a lot of the developers are seeking and the monitoring of the various items that that the IRA Act is imposing on us developers in order to get those credits, and whether developers such as NG and everyone else in the world is complying accurately to those standards.
Well, and Jana, I can't let you move on without your 1 to 10 of like gauging the status of the legal environment for clean energy. So where would you put it?
Probably a 6 or 7, just like Matt said.
Yeah, well, that makes it seem a little dicey and worthwhile to be having this conversation. So let's dive into this this issue of community opposition a little bit more, because, you know, we hear about that in the news. You see the Facebook groups that form anti-wind or anti-solar, and you hear a lot of backstory about, you know, the interests that are supporting that opposition. But how do we see that manifest through litigation then? Are there any cases that we can even pull from to see how this is playing out in the courts?
So let's take the example of the Mammoth Solar Project in Indiana. It's one of the pending mega projects. It's estimated to cost in excess of $1.5 billion to construct. It's going to sit on 4,500 acres of farmland in an area almost as large as Manhattan. Homeowners in proximity gathered together, created one of those groups you were talking about, and challenged the zoning approval for the Mammoth Solar Project. Now, this is the type of approval that gets challenged a lot of times in these community opposition cases. It's some kind of governmental approval, whether it's a zoning approval, you know, environmental protection permit, something like that. In this instance, it led to litigation, and a trial court and an intermediate appellate court sided with the homeowners, finding that they, one, had standing to challenge the zoning approval, and two, that the approval was, quote, arbitrary and capricious. Now, I'm using some legal speak, so let's break it down, because this is two really important concepts. What is standing, and what is the standard of review? Meaning, what standard is the court using to review the decision? What standard is the court using when it's making its determination? Standing is the concept of everyone in the world doesn't have the right to challenge something. They have to have some kind of particularized interest in what's going on, in this instance, in the siting and development of the Mammoth Solar Project, in order to be able to challenge. So here, homeowners in an immediate vicinity had standing. And that's one of the reasons the Mammoth Solar Project is a great example here. It breaks down a lot of the different components of this. And so this is often a dispute when we get into these litigation contexts of who has standing to challenge and who doesn't. In this instance, the homeowners, because they were so close, some were hundreds of feet away, all were within a mile, they had standing. The second thing I mentioned was the standard of review. Arbitrary and capricious standard is a very high standard of review. People are familiar with the standard in criminal trials. Everyone knows what beyond a reasonable doubt means, right? But there are many different standards that courts use in different contexts. As I mentioned, community opposition litigation usually involves a challenge to a form of governmental approval, and governmental approvals are usually judged on the, quote, arbitrary and capricious standard, which is very deferential to the government authority's decision. Mammoth Solar failed to meet, in this instance, they lost their litigation on the basis of the arbitrary and capricious standard because the court determined that they did not submit a complete zoning application and the applicable zoning ordinance required a complete application. Now, that might sound silly, but that's the kind of technicality that allows plaintiffs, you know, communities to overcome the arbitrary and capricious standard. Because usually, if a government agency can set forth a rational basis based on the facts and the record, then they're going to win on an arbitrary and capricious standard. But it's these moments where one of the procedural elements was not complied with, or there's some kind of fairness aspect that isn't worked, or there's something really egregious that will see the arbitrary and capricious standard, you know, flip over and work in favor of community opposition. However, these victories are often procedural in nature. That's a good thing for Mammoth and a bad thing for the communities. Obviously, Mammoth Solar can file a complete zoning application and go through the process again. That may take time. They may have to make concessions to the community during this period of time. And the community's probably hoping that they can extract concessions or change political winds in favor for the project. But we'll have to see how that plays out. We don't know where it's going here yet. I'm not involved in this litigation directly, and I haven't seen any reporting on which path Mammoth Solar is taking with the future of the project. It is important to note that there are several other projects that are in the same position. You know, the Aramis Solar Energy Project, the JVR Energy Park Project, the Three Point Solar Project. And when I say they're in the same position, I mean that they are also facing community opposition. You know, taking the Aramis just as a quick point, they have withstood challenges to date. And so it's very rare, I would say, for community challenges to work. And that's one of the things that makes Mammoth Solar such an interesting piece.
Hey, Factor This listeners, it's John Engel. I wanted to let you know that you can now watch every new episode of the Factor This podcast on YouTube. Just search Renewable Energy World and leave a rating and review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Mammoth as your example, because just the quick plug, in episode, I think it was 20, we interviewed Solve Energy CEO George Hirschman. Solve is the EPC on the Mammoth project, building it for Doral. So if you want to get some context, in that episode that we did was completely about NIMBYism. So there's some crossover here. Is this primarily popping up? And either of you can take this question. Is it mostly dealing with these utility scale, these very large projects, or do you see it on the DG side as well?
I think we see it on the DG side as well. I think it's just a general nature of renewable energy, whether it's wind or solar, where there's people out there in the world who are just opposed to renewable energy. And I do wonder, even after learning about the Mammoth case, and whether the landowner or the homeowners got lucky with the fact that applications or the procedures weren't followed properly, and hence the court ruled in their favor, or whether the particular landowner knew right off the bat that they had a case and contacted an attorney to file a lawsuit to challenge this, to challenge the approval. One of the, and this is maybe beyond the conversation of this podcast, but, you know, I try to advise my developers who go out there in the field to make friends with the homeowners that they're approaching in order to obtain site control and to get the feel of the neighborhood, of to see how much challenge may we face when going for permitting or going for any approvals that are needed prior to construction of the project, so that A, it's not a surprise to us, and two, that be prepared to what's going to be presented at the hearings for permitting.
That's such a good point. And it's something that we hear a lot when we talk to developers as well, that it's a tough balance for them, because, you know, development shops keep so much of their plans close to the vest early on as they're working through origination and you know, site control. And so it's maybe difficult to get in much earlier on the front end for those education opportunities. And George mentioned in his interview that, you know, Solve has tried to take more of a permanent presence in those communities that they're operating in. That project is 13,000 acres. I mean, it's huge. So you're talking about a ton of landowners that you're dealing with. So it's not just, you know, the one-off threat that you face. You can face challenges from hundreds of landowners in these certain situations. Matt, is there anything that comes to mind, I guess, in this topic that we're under right now, that is more of that death nail challenge to a project, instead of just, say, you know, resubmit your zoning permit? Is there something that can really tank a project from that legal standpoint for good?
Usually not from a straight legal perspective. I mean, these are usually procedural victories where a project can be reconfigured. Now, maybe the reconfiguration of the project will sort of defeat economic balances or make the project unworthwhile anymore for different reasons. Or maybe the challenge will, you know, let's say you get your approvals for your project under a friendly government administration, and then you're in a less friendly government administration and you lose your approvals, then you might have been pushed out into a position. So it's really the other issues that are at play that can cause real project delays and terminations. But these claims themselves, you know, usually don't, or usually per se are not triggers for that kind of deal ending risks.
Oh, Yana, did you have something you wanted to add there?
I just I wanted to give an example of something that not necessarily I was involved with, but where the developer has not started construction on time and let the permit expire. And the original permit was obtained, you know, at least 2 years prior to when the project was supposed to start construction. And since the expiration of the permit, the people who were sitting on a municipal board to approve the permits has changed because of you know, they get reelected. And the developer lost the permit because when they submitted the new application to renew, nothing, the economics of the project have not changed. The site did not change. The only thing changed is new people sitting on the board to approve the renewal of the permit. And I think that kind of like dives into, I think, what Matt was going to talk about, what he mentioned about the municipality challenges that we also face in the renewable energy world.
Exactly. So it sort of dovetails with sometimes the people who are mad about your project are not just the community members. Sometimes it's the municipalities as well. And we've seen states like California and New York create statewide siting agencies to help move renewable energy projects forward. But what that does is override a long-standing history in the United States of what's called home rule, where all of the small municipalities or, you know, governing entities, townships across a state govern themselves or have lots of control over land use. And we're seeing this shift from local control to state control of renewable energy siting issues. And there's good reason for this, because as of 2021, more than 100 ordinances across 31 states have been passed blocking new solar development and wind projects. And we all understand that we need more renewable energy adoption, and it needs to go somewhere. So this is the solution of trying to figure out, okay, how do we fairly address everyone's concerns and put this in the right place? So we see the municipal challenges come through on the ordinance basis, you know, through the enactment of local legislation. But now we're also seeing municipalities pushing back against these state siting boards again, and we have litigation out of Massachusetts, which is supporting the ability of the overriding really of home rule, out of New York as well, you know, and we're having this trend of shifting control for the approval of solar and renewable energy projects from a county or city level to a state level. I think that these cases are going to, they'll continue to play out as more states adopt this type of legislation, adopt this type of program. But I think we're going to see it continue to move the same way, where we're going to see these state boards supported. The challenges in this instance are often constitutional challenges, because these are statutorily created boards. And this is not necessarily a challenge to a specific unique project. These challenges often come up in the context of a specific unique project, but they're challenges to this whole new regime of reviewing and siting facilities. Which has bases and historical precedents, but we're seeing it, you know, expand in the renewable energy industry and have these challenges. But, you know, the constitutional challenge that's made, you know, is hard to make. I mean, you know, we see these things come up in the context of freedom of liberty and personal rights. And while constitutional challenges still can play out in this a little bit, those often are very difficult for municipalities to pursue as well. And I'm not sure that I'm aware of a single case where one of these state siting boards has been overruled by the courts. So I think that it's a rather safe aspect of it, although this litigation may delay some projects going forward.
Well, and yeah, that's the point too, in that the legal strength of these cases, of the challenges, may not be great, but they're effective in delaying and adding cost to a project and can push a project to the point where it doesn't pencil out. Like, if you have to continue to factor this all into your budget and that balloons and this project is just not, you know, worth it anymore, that's an effective tactic by people who are opposing these projects. So certainly something to still be concerned about. Matt, you set it up well when we got started. What about this consumer protection issue? There seems to be a lot of focus on protecting consumers from, you know, fraud and misrepresentation. How is that impacting solar, or going to impact solar and the broader clean energy industry this year and beyond?
So when we were just talking about the community opposition and the municipal challenges, the law was on the side of the developers. you know, it was siding with the developers and the people who are approving their projects. When we switch over into the consumer protection issues, the law generally protects consumers way more than it protects developers in the consumer-developer relationship. And it's coming up in, I'd say, two really distinct contexts. I mean, first and foremost, it comes up when we have a connection between a solar project and a consumer. So historically, that has meant the residential solar, you know, industry. But with the expansion and success of community solar projects, we're seeing a larger group of companies enter into direct relationships with consumers. And so there have been a number of litigations. Now, usually consumer protection, consumer fraud cases are instituted by state attorneys general, and they're under some kind of state law that protects a consumer from fraud or misleading activities. And those have come up recently in for instance, in Minnesota, and the attorney general filed suit against Brio Energy for misrepresentations and fraud in connection with the sales process. And so that's one of the places this comes up, where you are selling residential systems, and the numbers you're putting out or the ways in which you're marketing it are deemed to be misleading, confusing, or predatory towards residents. There's also billing practices that have been implicated in certain instances, where the billing practices that are used have been misleading or overcharging, really, and that again is litigation by attorneys general that are correcting this mistake on behalf of the larger consumer industry. Now, the laws in place are generally very protective of consumers, as I noted, but we're also seeing new legislation being put into place across the country in different places that aims to provide additional protections to consumers. You know, one example of this is in New Jersey. There's pending litigation legislation that would require the sale of a home with a residential unit to include with a residential solar project on it to include certain disclosures about who the company is. So just to sort of tie the company to the project a little bit more. And so it's something that, as I said, impacts the residential solar market, but because of community solar projects is going to impact a lot more. And community solar comes with a lot of regular touch points with the community and with a lot of community members. And so it is, I think, going to be a source of this type of litigation in the future.
Yana, you're on the DG team and NG works in community solar. Do you have some thoughts on that?
I have not personally have been involved with any of the consumer protection litigation or issues. At least I have not, nothing has come across my desk, so I really can't comment on that.
Fair enough. And we wouldn't want you to speculate on behalf of your corporation either. What's another trend maybe that you can pull out for our listeners that might not be on their radar? They've heard about NIMBYism. They've maybe heard about, you know, municipal challenges, and this consumer protection issue, like you said, Matt, is popping up now that community solar is expanding across the country. Is there one thing or maybe two things that stand out as the industry needs to know about this but might not have it front of mind?
Yeah, I think that answer is climate and environmental. And we all know about climate because that's why we're doing this, right? Many of us. But how does that intersect with the litigation risks for solar projects? So let's take the example of Honeybee Ranch in California. This is a ranch in California that was located next to, a mid-sized solar project. And the solar developer constructed on the property, and according to the court documents, did not conduct certain grading activities or stormwater management activities that it had promised to do, and therefore there was significant stormwater flow and flooding to the adjacent Honeybee Ranch, and that ranch was awarded $6.5 million in damages because of that stormwater runoff.
Wow.
Flooding is going to be more and more of a problem for the world in general over the next decade. And so solar projects, you know, if not designed properly or if not built properly, can have significant stormwater impacts, flooding impacts, because we're creating impervious surface, especially if we're building on green lands or, you know, rooftops, obviously not a risk there. But otherwise, we are creating these areas of impervious cover, potentially changing runoff, and that can be exacerbated by climate and also just be a general environmental harm that's occurring. And we've seen this in a couple, in several different instances. And I think we're going to see more of this. I think we're also going to see litigation, you know, over how climate is impacting the solar industry. You know, I think we'll probably see insurance litigation arising from greater storms or fires or different things like that. And those aren't necessarily really insurance specific, but I think we're going to see this intersection of climate coming up in different ways. And it's important to really focus on environmental issues as you are developing projects. You know, although I'm not involved with the Honeybee Ranch project, it sounds like it probably was avoidable. And so that's a way to sort of mitigate your risks. But a lot of times I understand that gets passed down to contractors. You know, there's lots of subcontractors on jobs. And so it can be difficult to make those, to control at all of those levels. And I think that comes up in the context of, you know, a case in Massachusetts recently where, you know, a Pennsylvania-based company was sued for another sort of similar runoff issue where there was, you know, construction debris that had come from the property, from the solar development into a nearby river. And these types of risks are things that, you know, the solar companies really, I think, can protect against through insurance, through subcontractor control, but it's something with the emergence, with the continuing focus on climate and weather events that I think we're going to see more and more of and might not be on people's radar.
When you're talking a lot too about this, like the importance of the block and tackle, like get the fundamentals and the foundational pieces of development right so that you don't run into these hurdles, these legal challenges down the road. But it does also feed into the NIMBYism conversation that if we don't get these steps right and we give more fuel to that opposition, they will point to these cases and these stories and communities where it didn't go well or where there was a runoff issue or where there was a negative impact. Is that something you guys talk about inside NG, Yana, that, you know, it's so important to get these pieces right so that we don't, you know, stab ourselves in the foot?
We talk about those things enormous amount with the developers, with engineering teams, with the civil engineering teams. That I think that's the most, the biggest issue that sometimes that comes across my desk on a landowner complaints of water runoffs and things like that. And honestly, there are times when you try to do everything right and the weather and the environment is just not cooperating with you. It's just out of your hands and you deal with it as things come. You try to be, there's some states that are a lot more involved with the stormwater runoffs than others. We've had, Massachusetts is very strict, but we work hand in hand together to make sure that those problems don't exist. But again, sometimes those things are just unavoidable.
But it sounds like you agree with Matt too that is one of those maybe lesser known challenges facing developers that we should be more aware of and maybe keep more front and center.
Absolutely. Another item I think I wanted to mention is which. I don't know if this will come in my lifetime or Matt's lifetime, but, renewable energy is not new to this, to the United States, but I've not been involved with many projects that are in the decommissioning stages of the project lifespan, but I can totally foresee decommissioning issues being raised as another litigation challenge that may start arising more and more as, you know, the more projects are built, the more, you know, an average project life is what, sometimes 15, 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
Sometimes or longer. They're renewed,
or longer, exactly. So there's times when I, you know, when we talk about decommissioning with our asset operations teams, and I, in the back of my mind, I'm like, I hope I'm not here when this happens. just because I have not been involved with any decommissioning issues yet, but I can see that being at the forefront of the litigation risks.
Well, and you're right. The industry will have to evolve as it matures and it ages. And I'm sure that like your roles will also, you know, evolve to be able to address those issues as they start popping up a lot more. Yeah, that's an issue 20 years down the line. And even some of the older utility scale projects in the US, I mean, that's still probably 10, 15 years down the line from now. So, you know, we haven't really had to come to grips with that yet. And that's another, you know, issue that we talk about on this podcast too, with the circular economy discussions and recycling of panels. All of that is fairly new to this industry, at least in the US. And we're kind of learning as we go. So that's a good point. And I'm interested, maybe we'll have to revisit that in another conversation, Yana, about, you know, how your teams start to think about that now so that you're not caught in that precarious position a couple decades from now. Let's hit this last topic before I let you guys go. But what about the more traditional litigation between members within the industry over, you know, breach of contract or a competition issue? We are starting to see some patent litigation pop up in solar around, you know, modules and balance of systems and all these different things. Is that also a threat to the project owner developer?
Yeah, I think those types of patent litigation less so, but we're definitely seeing that trend of, you know, of lots of the traditional breach of contract competition type litigation, you know, that we'd expect to see. I think the aspect of this that people might not be thinking about is how it intersects with the available incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. And again, yeah, you made the point earlier. At the end of the day, developers need to understand the issues and try to, you know, cross all the T's and dot all the I's. And the Inflation Reduction Act incentives, you know, include certain additional requirements. And I'm sure all the listeners know this, but it has bonuses for things like prevailing wage, domestic content, those different factors, which are going to be things that are in the control of the developer, but also certain subcontractors. So I'm expecting that there are going to be, you know, there's going to be substantial contractual terms surrounding whose responsibility it is to make sure that the prevailing wage is paid, or that everyone's paying prevailing wage, or the content used meets the domestic content standards. And so it's really important to put those systems in place and to place responsibility appropriately and thoroughly in your contracts. But then on the back end, it's just not always going to work out. Sometimes the contracts aren't going to be clear. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it's just not going to work for some other reason. You had to bring in an emergency contractor for some reason. He didn't get paid prevailing wage. It was done by a subcontractor and the prime contractor doesn't know about it. Project loses its exception. You know, that's a sort of draconian example. We don't know that it's going to play out like that, but that's going to lead to litigation.
Yeah. And I'm glad you pointed that out, because right after the Inflation Reduction Act was announced. So that was, now it's hard to even remember. Was that back in August? Something like that. August of last year, I think, is when it first heard about it. Maybe I'm mixing up when the bill was signed. Either way, I was talking to a developer, a head of an engineering department at a community solar development firm. And, you know, I was like, how excited are you about the IRA? And he's like, it's great. And it's obviously a historic piece of legislation. But when you look at the changes to the ITC PTC, you mentioned bonuses for domestic content. Some of them aren't bonuses. You know, to get from 6%, which is the baseline, to 30%, you do have to meet that prevailing wage requirement and the apprenticeship. I believe that's baked into that core percentage. And I was talking to him about the apprenticeship aspect of it, and he was just getting stressed out about managing, you know, 150 to 300 people on a project. And like you said, making sure that throughout the project development life cycle, that each of these varying teams and companies are meeting their responsibilities, he's like, this could potentially be a mess. And it's a piece of the ITC that we all need and is not just a nice to have. And I'm hearing that a lot. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but I wonder how developers are approaching that. And they're all waiting for this guidance from Treasury and the IRS. Just as we're recording this, just 2 days ago, we got that first piece of IRS guidance on tax credits surrounding low-income communities and energy communities. But we've been waiting months to get those details on what it exactly applies to and who it applies to and how you apply and when you can submit your application, all these things. Jana, are you guys talking about this a lot on just how we're going to navigate what is clearly a historic time for this industry, but also it's getting a lot more complicated?
Absolutely. It's been a hot topic on conversation and inside my company. As we discussed, it's going to be another full-time job for somebody in order to monitor and in order to comply with all the various various items that the Act imposes upon you in order to get those credits. And we're thankfully are not super in a rush to get everything updated and as far as our contracts are concerned, as because of the certain provisions in the law where you're grandfathered in for certain projects that are being built this year. However, we are waiting on that guidance because, as you said, that it's not clear as of yet exactly what will qualify as compliance with the apprenticeship program or the prevailing wage program and things like that. But I know that we, as much as we would like to put that on the contractors, you know, in our contracts, you know, give the responsibility of the compliance onto the contractors, we in the background will be also requesting all the documentation to kind of like a CYA on our part so that in the event the contractor fails to comply, we know what's happening and in order to avoid the problems arising in the future.
Well, let's wrap up with this, Jana. I've been wanting to ask you this just throughout our conversation, but maybe we've already touched on it. But I'm interested to hear what maybe two or three of the bigger risks that NG sees, whether, you know, that's shared outwardly or just within your team on litigation and these issues that we've been discussing. Are there a few items that pop up more than others and are you know, the core of your work? And maybe it's better described as the things that keep you up at night, but I'm interested to hear if you've got a few to share.
Well, after I left private practice, nothing really keeps me up at night anymore, but
cool as a cucumber. But, yeah.
Yes.
Good for you.
At least trying to.
We love that.
I think number one is landowner disputes. You know, we sometimes, you know, the contract sets certain things and a landowner disagrees with either what was signed or it could very well be that the developer, us, screwed something up. And so, you know, in order to avoid litigation, there's a lot of massaging that takes place in our world. But obviously litigation is always threatened. If you don't do this, we're going to sue you. Permitting is a challenge. I have not been involved with litigation on that part. There's a couple of times we thought about, you know, filing a suit if a permit was denied, but eventually decided that it was not worth our time. Those are the two, I guess, contracts. Similarly, well, as landowner.
And just before you get to your last one, I'm mm-hmm. interested if you can even speak ambiguously enough that we wouldn't know what the project was or what the specific case was. But when you say, mm-hmm. you know, you decided not even to bring litigation because of a zoning or permitting issue, did that lead to NG just walking away from a project altogether?
Exactly.
Interesting. Yep. So was mm-hmm. that because of this is just going to take too much, you know, time and resources for us? Because, you know, we were having the conversation earlier with Matt asking if, you know, any of these issues on technicalities are a death nail to a project. It did get to that point for your teams.
Yeah. For this particular project I'm speaking about, it was, if it was just permitting, it would have been one thing, but there was other items, other factors that were playing against us where taken as a whole was just not worth our time pursuing.
Got it. Interesting. And your last point, sorry for jumping in there.
No, that's okay. Maybe contractor disputes probably. We we have our own engineering for, at least on the DG side, have our own engineers who work on our projects, and contractor disputes is sometimes tends to be an issue. So those are the top three that pop in my head that come across my desk. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Yana. Matt, any last words for us before we wrap up here? And for those that maybe recognize your name from floating around renewable energy world, Matt will blog from time to time for us on what he's seeing in the marketplace. But any last comments?
I think, you know, despite all the risks we're talking about, I'm still quite optimistic for the renewable energy industry. I think some of these things are the cost of doing business, especially when we talk about the mega projects. And there certainly are factors that make projects a little more lightning rod for litigation risks, like the size of the project, like the communities they're being placed in. I even think whether it's, you know, whether it's some kind of hot button issue that intersects with the project, like a significant portion being put on farmland. But those aren't reasons, I think, to be down on renewable energy or on any specific project. They're just reasons to, you know, be very careful in your siting and development.
Matt and Yana, I really appreciate you for joining the podcast, and hopefully you've helped some in our audience, whether with legal backgrounds or not, navigate some of these challenges that are surely ahead of us, especially over this next decade as we try to deploy. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks again to Matthew Carmel and Yana Spitzer for joining the podcast. Factor This is a production of Renewable Energy World and Clarion Energy. Join us every Monday as we break down solar's most important topics with industry leaders who actually move the needle. And please leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factor This from Renewable Energy World. Hey, it's John Engel, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.